Hello and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And we always think, we always have a prejudice that we're closer to the Orthodox than we are to our other fellow Christians, certainly all having to do with the bishops and priests of Orthodoxy truly having holy orders, and the sacraments being valid, there being the same number of sacraments, all of that suggests the ancient closeness of Orthodoxy and Catholicism. But that closeness can sometimes breed difficulties that are maybe deeper than the difficulties that exist between Catholics and other Christians. And so Catholic Answers has a brand new book out from our guest today, Michael Loft, and it's called Answering Orthodoxy, A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East. Congratulations on the book, Michael.
Hey, thank you so much, Cy. It's an honor.
I just want to let people know what the book is. Like, what you're getting when you get it is not some kind of PhD, you know, thesis or something like that. It's made for people to read and understand what are the things that are actually points of friction, points of difficulty between the Catholics and the Orthodox. And so Michael's got 30 of them in here. They're simple things like the Eucharist, the Eastern churches in the first millennium never accepted papal infallibility. Okay, so that would be an objection. And then Mike will give you a few pages on that. On that one, actually, quite a few pages that are written in a prose that you can understand about what the Catholic response is to that. So this is a Catholic response to attacks from the East. And we're going to focus on one of them today, Michael. All right?
Sounds good to me, yeah.
And that is that the Pope was merely a first among equals in the first millennium. And yeah. Before I get into the question with you, I feel like when we say in the first millennium, what we're saying is in a period of time that almost nobody alive today remembers, therefore you can say almost anything you want about it.
that might be true. But one of the reasons why we highlight the first millennium is because we generally agree, even though there were some disputes in the first millennium, East and West tended to be in communion with one another. So we both tend to look to the first millennium as a standard for doctrine. So whatever unity we had in the first millennium and whatever understanding we had of doctrine then that we shared together, we can see as a common path for us to reunite because those are the things that
point.
We agreed on.
Yeah, right. Yeah, okay, so you look back to before the divorce, so to speak, and you say,
exactly.
What did we have in common? Okay, so then is it right to say that the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, was considered just first among equals by both Catholics and and Orthodox people in the first millennium?
I don't believe that is accurate when we look at the evidence. And that's one of the things that I attempt to do throughout the book. And I'm glad you mentioned its readability, because I wrote it in such a fashion that a person who doesn't have any knowledge of church history could approach the book and understand it.
Yeah.
So there's no requisite knowledge here. But I do tackle historical questions on this subject. What authority did the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, actually have in the first millennium? Now, many Orthodox today are going to say he's first among equals. And what that effectively means is that he is equal to all other bishops. You know, no one bishop is greater than another. But the first part there of the first among equals refers to, well, he has the most honor out of these various bishops. But that honor doesn't translate into power. It doesn't translate into authority. It might be prestige. And they'll generally say that prestige was due to a couple factors. The fact that in the early church, Rome, the Church of Rome, had many, many popes who were martyrs for the faith. So their witness to the faith in the first few centuries was incredible. So they produced a lot of martyrs. And also, Rome was the seat of the empire at the time. And so it was a very, very prominent place, the most prominent place in the empire. And so its bishop is generally going to be seen as one of the most prominent. In the same way, you might say, okay, the Bishop of New York, you know, Cardinal Dolan. You might say, well, he is over a very prominent seat because of New York's relationship to the United States. Or likewise, we could say the same thing about, the bishop over the territory of Washington, D.C.
Sure, gotcha.
So yeah. People would have said the same thing back then about Rome. And Orthodox will say, well, that is why he was prominent. But that doesn't translate into authority, such as the Pope having the ability to go into a bishop's territory and say, you need to ordain this person, or don't ordain that person, or you need to do this, don't do that. They would say he doesn't have that kind of authority. Whereas Catholics argue, according to the First Vatican Council, where we defined this as a dogma, that he actually does have that authority. But this did not come out of nowhere at Vatican I. We have a very long-standing history of this in the first millennium. And that's what I do, is I show various councils that both Catholics and Eastern Orthodox agree on, which we would consider ecumenical. We would consider these to be some of the most important councils in the first millennium. Well, these councils, when they spoke of the Pope's authority, it wasn't merely a first among equals. He actually had an authority to bind consciences, even in matters of faith and morals. And he got that authority not simply by being prominent, not because Rome had a lot of martyrs, but especially because Christ gave him that authority through the authority that he gave to St. Peter. And the Bishop of Rome, as the successor of St. Peter, then carries out that authority.
Okay, so if it's a history question, we mostly must look to documents, I suppose. What might be the kind of document, or maybe we don't look to documents, maybe we look for behaviors that we have record of, popes did this, popes didn't do that. So what would be the things that the Orthodox would point to in the first millennium to support this position that they have, that, look, when we were together, it was this way. The Pope was important, but he was the first among equals, which, as you said, is really a prescription for the future. If it's what we see in the past, that is to say, when we go back to that, we can be together once again. So, what's the evidence that they? What is the documentary evidence or the habits of the Church they might point to that support this idea?
Generally, the ecumenical councils, because if we're not going to point towards documents that we agreed upon. Teachings. Mm-hmm. If we're going to say behavior, well, behavior can be interpreted in multiple ways.
I see.
People who dissented against the teaching that Jesus is consubstantial with the Father, those people in the first millennium, you can interpret that one of two ways. They were either being faithful to the true teaching by dissenting against this teaching, or they were dissenting against the true teaching and thus being unfaithful. So it kind of has to presuppose a pre-existing theology to know which one it is, because behavior can be interpreted one way or another. So if you see a pope, for instance, binding consciences to a particular teaching, or even interfering in the territory and jurisdiction of another bishop in the East, it could be interpreted one of two ways.
I see.
A Catholic could say, hey, he has that authority. There's the papacy in action. Whereas an Orthodox could come along and say, no, he's abusing his authority. He doesn't have that authority. So that's why we ultimately have to go to, okay, well, what do the documents that we both agree on profess to be true?
Gotcha. Okay.
And when we look at those documents in the first millennium, especially in the ecumenical councils that we both accept, they are going to be in favor of the Catholic position.
All right, so give me some of that documentary evidence, if you would, some of the things from the first millennium of the Church that say, look, the Pope wasn't thought of as the first among equals. He was something else.
Yeah, he was more than that.
Yeah.
There are so many, but probably my most favorite is Pope Agatho's letter to the Roman Emperor at the time of the Sixth Ecumenical Council. He writes a letter to
the emperor.
Could you
give me a date? I don't know when Pope Agatho was.
Yeah. Yes, 680 to 681.
Okay, all right.
And so he writes this letter to the emperor, And that letter is then read out in front of this council. It's called Constantinople 3, 682, 681. It is our sixth ecumenical council for both Catholics and Orthodox. So we agree on this council. And this letter includes the claim that the Pope receives his supremacy over the other churches, not merely from canons and decisions of councils or the prominence of the city of Rome in relation to the Roman Empire, but because of a divine promise of Jesus Christ that he made to St. Peter. And then it goes on to note that the teaching authority of Rome has always been preserved from error and will be undefiled unto the end. So until the end, not just until that time, but forever, it will always be undefiled in its teaching. Again, not just because they have a lot of holy people there, not because maybe a particular council said this or that about it, but because of a divine promise that Jesus made to Peter when he told Peter, Satan has desired to sift you like wheat, but I have prayed that your faith will not fail. And the Pope took that passage about Peter and he says that's true about his successors, that his faith, that is his teachings, would not fail. Now, how did the Eastern Fathers at this council react? Because it's an Eastern council. It's in Constantinople. The only representation from the West there are the representatives of the Pope. Everybody else that's there, all the bishops are Eastern. How did they react? Did they say, that's heresy? No way. You're just the first among equals. You don't have that kind of authority to bind consciences and to teach infallibly. You don't have that. No, they received the letter and they explicitly wrote back to the Pope as part of the council. And they accepted the letter. They say, we agree with everything written in this thing.
Wow.
So they embraced the claim, not only that the Pope has been free from error in his teachings up until that point, but his teachings would be undefiled unto the end.
Isn't that something that, like, they wouldn't use the modern language that we use? They wouldn't, like, you don't hear the words papal infallibility or that kind of thing, or it doesn't have the legal kind of wording that we use in the Catholic Church. But the core of it is there, which is that Peter and his successors have been given a guarantee that they won't fail in being faithful to what it is Christ wants transmitted.
Yeah. And so you're right. They're not going to use the word papal infallibility, but the concept is there. And what I point out in the book is when Orthodox scholars look at this event, when Protestant scholars look at it, and when Catholic scholars look at it, I show they all agree that the seeds of Vatican I's papal infallibility is right there in the council. Mm-hmm. They connect that dot. They agree. Catholics, Protestant, and Orthodox scholars are willing to admit, yeah, this is papal infallibility being proclaimed at the council. And it's interesting to see Orthodox scholars admitting that.
And so I'm just curious, though. So when an Orthodox scholar does that, the person is clearly still Orthodox. So are they admitting that and saying this is something that we need to deal with? Like, what do you see as the secondary things that happened? If the primary thing is acknowledging, okay, yeah, in the 600s here, we have papal infallibility declared by a council. What's the follow on reaction of that from Orthodox scholars?
Yeah. And it's a wonderful question. You know, how is it that an Eastern Orthodox scholar could recognize that and yet still remain Orthodox? Because this is inconsistent with current Eastern Orthodox theology. Yeah, so effectively what some theologians and scholars would do, and particularly the one that I quote does, is he wants to say, okay, well, yeah, the council said this and agreed to it, but you have to look at the way they behaved outside of this. Did they really accept that in their actions? You know, of course, they're wanting to get along with Rome at the time, but in reality, in practice, feet on the ground, did they really believe this thing? And he would, of course, suggest no. But I don't think that does any service to the Orthodox position, because what he would be ultimately saying is the Council Fathers are hypocrites, that they say one thing and do another, and that they don't really believe what they profess to believe.
Yeah.
And so that doesn't help the Orthodox case. And number two, if they are hypocrites, that is, the Council Fathers, upon what basis can I accept them as reliable witnesses in Christology, which is the main thing they were dealing with,
right,
was Christological matters. If they're hypocrites and if they're willing to just say whatever for political reasons, might they be doing that with their Christology too? The Oriental Orthodox might even say yes.
Yeah, so that's right.
It kind of plays into their hands.
Right. Right. The Nestorians are all raising their hand going, excuse me. Okay. So, do you have more? You want to give us some more examples of documentary evidence of the place of the Pope in the first millennium?
Yeah, there's also what's called the formula of Hermisdas. And Pope Hermisdas was a pope in the 500s, and there are all kinds of Christological problems going on at the time. And the East for a while had embraced heresy on the matter of Christology. And so it was out of communion with the Bishop of Rome, who was holding to the faith. Well, whenever the East got around to wanting to embrace Orthodoxy, the Pope gives them particular terms to reestablish communion. And in these terms, in what's called the formula of Hermisdas, it's a document that the Eastern bishops have to sign off on, which many bishops did. Many Orthodox bishops signed off on the document, and it explicitly teaches the papal claims in there, the Catholic understanding of the papacy. This says he's more than a first among equals. He actually has authority to bind consciences, to teach, and even to interfere in the affairs of a local bishop. So he has that authority of governance over the entire church. And so those papal claims are inserted into the formula of Hermisdas as a condition for the Eastern bishops to sign off on. And they did. The Eastern Emperor at the time signed off on it. The Patriarch of Constantinople and the vast majority of the other bishops in the East signed off on the formula of Hermisdas, which included the papal claims. Now, somebody might say in response, well, but there were different versions of the formula of Hermisdas that were floating around out there. And, you know, some of these bishops may have signed a different version. No, it's true. There were different versions, but none of them had differences on the papal claims. They were all consistent on the papal claims. The differences in the versions that were in circulation had to do with the names of particular bishops that were condemned. Some bishops that want to condemn particular individuals and figures that they venerated. So they might say, okay, well, I can sign off on this thing if you take that person's name out because I don't want to condemn that person by name. That's what they differed on. They did not differ on the papal claims. So here's another perfect example where the Eastern churches are signing off on the papal claims. And then I have others even from another ecumenical council.
Okay.
Like Nicaea II, for instance. This is in 787. This is the seventh ecumenical council. And it's curious because at this time, Pope Hadrian, he's effectively triumphant over the iconoclast heresy that this council put down. This notion that we are to smash and break religious icons and images because it's a violation of God's prohibition against images in the Old Testament. And so the truth that Rome was preaching, that you can have images, that was triumphant at this council. But in addition to that victory, Pope Hadrian's ecclesiology, that is his understanding of the papacy and how the church works and functions, was explicit in defending the papal claims, and he asserts that at the council through his representatives. His representatives read letters from Pope Hadrian in front of the entire council fathers, all of them Eastern fathers, explicitly asserting the papal claims. And they sign off on it. They're in agreement with it. They all acclaim, we agree with your letters. And yet they're teaching the papal claims. So we have the papal claims being taught not at just one ecumenical council, and not even just at two, but actually even three, if we talk about Ephesus in the year 431, the third ecumenical council. And so that's kind of what I do in the book, is I show, okay, well, you're making this claim. You're saying that the Pope is merely a first among equals. But does that really work when we look at the evidence that we both agree on in the ecumenical councils?
That's the service that you do, because I started by saying, you know, the first millennium, there's very few people who have any familiarity with what the church was like and how the church functioned. And this is a very accessible way to get those details that are very, very helpful. The Pope was merely a first among equals in the first millennium is chapter 20. There's 30 of these in Michael's book, Answering Orthodoxy, a Catholic Response to Attacks from the East. But I wanted to focus on this one because it is one that you hear a great deal. And I don't know enough history to go, well, wait a second. I know the Bible well enough to point to Peter, but obviously they have the Bible. There's no controversy about that. So we need someone to help us with these things. Okay, so the fact that we say the Pope is more than just the first among equals, it doesn't mean that the papacy has to look the way it looks today.
Absolutely. And so that's where there's some wiggle room. Yeah. We can certainly say that the Bishop of Rome does not necessarily have to determine who the next bishop is going to be for every particular territory. Right. And in fact, it's been a longstanding tradition in the East for them to generally govern themselves and determine for themselves who their bishops will be. And Rome can respect that. Mm-hmm. And only interfere if it's absolutely necessary. And you want Rome to have that authority to be able to interfere, because if something goes wrong on the local level, you want Rome to be able to intervene.
Right.
But it's one thing to be able to intervene whenever it's necessary. It's another thing to micromanage everything. And so we can agree, sure, in a reunified church, the Pope doesn't have to micromanage everything in the East. In fact, they'll be self-governing. They'll just simply need to accept the same profession of faith as the rest of Catholics, since we profess the same faith. And that's it. Require nothing of the East. Require no more of the East than was required of them in the first millennium. That's, in fact, something Ratzinger suggested. And I think that that is a good approach.
You know, I wonder, though, Michael, if that, and I think you and I may have talked about this before, and my thinking may have been formed. So I don't want to act like I'm coming up with this on my own, but it does strike me as, even if you did that, would the people accept it? Because we Catholics and Orthodox people, we don't know each other. We don't have any kind of familiarity with one another.
Yeah. So unfortunately, whenever we've had two reunification attempts in the past that were top down, both of them failed. And they failed because in the Eastern churches on the East, they effectively repudiated the reunions because the laity were not on board. So the bishops could generally get on board, at least in the Council of Florence in the second attempt. But the laity were not on board. So the top-down thing, it worked for the Western church, but not for the Eastern churches. So in other words, we're most likely going to have to work on reunification from the bottom up. And until we get to know one another at the local level, it's unlikely any kind of top-down reunification would be long-lasting.
But as Catholics, we can say, look, go back to the year, I don't know, 999 or something. And we could say, as Catholics, it's perfectly acceptable to a Catholic to say nothing need be required of the East that wasn't in practice and agreed upon on that date. And we can have a union that doesn't require juridical messing with Orthodoxy.
Right. Orthodoxy, we don't have to alter the way in which they administer their sacraments or engage in liturgical practices or even exercise discipline in their governance in their own churches. We don't have to interfere with that. They can retain all of that. We would just need to profess the same profession of faith, and Rome can let them continue to do their thing. So, yeah, as I think, as long as we make it clear that those are the conditions for reunification, I think a lot of Orthodox would be more agreeable, supposing that they realize when we say, hey, we need to agree with the profession of faith, as long as they understand that we're not teaching heresy, That's part of the problem. They think that maybe papal infallibility or papal supremacy or the filioque or purgatory are heresy. And so a lot of Orthodox right now want to say, well, yeah, it sounds really nice. We get to continue to function and govern our churches the way that we're doing before. That sounds nice, but you Catholics are teaching heresy and you're not teaching the proper faith. And so that's a problem. So until we work through those doctrinal issues, we're not going to have reunification because we can't profess the same profession of faith. But what I do in the book is I show, wait, we don't have any fundamental differences. Mm-hmm. When we look at the first millennium and what it professed on the faith, we don't have any differences. So our sources agree on the fundamentals. So if we can just get back to our sources and what they teach, we can agree fundamentally on the faith.
Answering Orthodoxy is the book. Michael Lofton is the author. Answering Orthodoxy, A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East. It's out now from Catholic Answers Press. Michael, always enlightening and helpful, and I appreciate that you do all that work that most of us can't do or won't do, so that we can look back, for example, into the first millennium and see things that are entirely opaque to us if someone doesn't bring them out. So thank you for the work, Michael.
And thank you so much for having me. It was an honor.
I know you have a cold, and try to keep that voice. When you're done with the cold, try to keep the killer voice.
Right.
Thanks for listening. We appreciate that you take the time with us. If you want to email us, send it to focus@catholic.com. We love getting your emails, focus@catholic.com. If you want to support us financially, it does cost a few dollars to keep these lights on. You can do that by going to givecatholic.com. And I will tell you this, Catholic Answers is a 4-star charity. So we will let you look at the books. We try to be as transparent as we can be. And I've recently learned that about us. So I wanted to share that with you. And wherever you're listening, if you'd give us that 5-star review, 4-star review, whatever they allow you to give, and a few nice words of a review, that helps to grow the podcast. That does it for us. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.